Remember, okay, no, so you're doing everything. Basically, the entire functions of the body. So any disruption is going to present a problem. When you fill out your databases and you do your assessment, you assess the level of consciousness, don't you? And what do you write? Written oriented. So are they oriented? Are they always alert? Sometimes they're not alert, are they? No. They may be oriented. They may be easily arousable and oriented. So don't put A and O. Put easily arousable and oriented. Okay? Or they may be somnolent. Or they may be sleeping. But arousable. They may be in a vegetative state. Okay. So don't just routinely go through and put A and O times 3. So the numbers are what? Just in review? Person, right? They're oriented to self, oriented to where they are in time, right? And sometimes some hospitals or some people use 4, which is situation. Because they may very well be able to tell you they're in a hospital and have not a clue why. And still wonder about those why the cat turned into a bed. Okay. So in that case, you would say alert oriented times 3 with feline hallucinations. Right? Okay. So I want you to go that part of your assessment. Ask a little more, what's going on? Cognitive functions, arousal functions, how the brain is working are all going to have to do with your patient's level of consciousness and cognition. Cognition defined is all mental abilities controlled by the suitable hemispheres. Okay? What can bother those, can damage that area, are strokes, demyelinating diseases, brainstem compression. We're going to talk about a lot of those things today. And levels of consciousness, as you well know, can result from changes in blood. Right? If they're not getting blood to that area, they're not getting oxygen, and therefore they're going to show some significant changes. Oxygen, glucose flow to the brain, changes in cell membranes. Whatever's going on with those tissues in the brain is going to affect the nerves, right? The process of the body. We're going to see it in cognition. And also many other manifestations. So cerebral or brain stem, okay, low brain stem dysfunction can be caused by bilateral hemispheric lesions, meaning lesions on either side of the brain, bilateral, can be caused by metabolic disorders. We talked about masses. Earlier in the semester, we talked about cancerous masses. We can have non-cancerous masses in the brain as well, or cancerous masses. As function deteriorates, your patients are going to be difficult to arouse. What, that lady that was in Santa Rosa, who had the woman with the respiratory problems? The opioids. Yeah, she was a perfect example, right? Can you tell us about her again? But now, not with respect to respiratory, with respect to her cognition.
She was under a lot of morphine to the point where she couldn't breathe. She couldn't
severely respiratory depressed because of too much morphine, right?
Yeah.
And then how was her cognition, though? What was happening there?
She just was so sedated, it was really hard to get her to wake up.
Respond.
Yeah.
So what were you doing to increase her responsiveness? She was becoming unresponsive, wasn't she, very quickly?
Yeah.
So what were the nurses doing? You were kind of taken back at this.
You had to kind of inflict some sort of pain.
They were eliciting pain. And that's, if you look at your neurological assessment of any of these computer charting programs, you will see response to pain. Do they respond to pain? And this was one reason, one way you got this woman to become conscious, right?
Yeah.
And I remember you were telling us how you elicited pain response.
They did the sternum rub.
Yeah, sternal friction rub.
And then it almost got to the point where we were going to have to, she had hip replacement, and they were going to touch the...
Yeah, the incision. Right. So the concept of response to pain is important. Okay, and in this case, we were causing a response to pain. to keep her at that level of cognition so she'd breathe. You want to keep her brain engaged so that she would breathe, and that's really important. And you can do that. You can coax someone to breathe, keep their level of consciousness up so that they'll maintain breathing. So level of consciousness is a lot more than just A and O times three. Okay? Like your patient at that point had lost it completely, right?
Yeah.
At one point in that. And become unresponsive. Okay, and right into that, you have respiratory manifestations of that. So not only was she going to stop breathing because of the opioids, but she was going to stop breathing because of her consciousness, if you guys didn't do something. This is what you're going to see. Did you see any? You just saw diminished breaths because of the opioids.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, but it's not uncommon to see changed strokes, some neurologic hyperventilation, all sorts of other odd respiratory patterns, as well as pupil manifestations. Did you notice anything in that lady's pupils? Were they getting enlarged or fixed? Or? No, not yet. Okay. That's the next thing. You start looking at their eyes and you start seeing doll's eyes fixation, a common oval pupils. Okay. Doll's eyes are when they're straight. Eyes of a doll. Motor manifestations, you want appropriate responses. Okay? You don't want to see flaccidity. What's flaccidity? Many of you have been through surgery, and that patient is completely under. What kind of muscle tone do they have? None. Right?
It's like dead weight.
Like dead meat.
Exactly.
So let's hope that this one loads faster. I'm going to show you some like dead meat. It's not really. I'm going to show some positioning, okay? That you can fix it. And remember. Let's hope it loads a little faster this time. This is a great video of positioning, because I can sit here and do it for you, you know, but it's much better to watch an actress. Okay, we're going to try a new one. This is not my computer, John. Right? This is a very slow internet.
I think it's the internet.
Patient is in the deportative position with the upper extremities in flexion, the lower extremities in extension, reflecting that the brainstem motor centers are working, but we don't have modulation of those centers from the cortical spinal tracts and their connection.
Should we listen to that from the beginning?
In the deportative position with the upper extremities in flexion, the lower extremities in extension, reflecting that the brainstem motor centers are working, but we don't have modulation of those centers from the cortical spinal tracts and their connections to the brainstem centers. If we now go a step lower as far as the level of dysfunction and eliminate the function of the rubrospinals, we go from decorticate to decerebrate posturing. The lower extremities stay in extension, now the upper extremities are in extension because we don't have any type of regulation or modulation at the vestibulospinal or the reticulospinal tracts, but we've eliminated the influence of the rubrospinal tracts at this point in time. If there's to be further progression and the patient has further deterioration, and we now eliminate the function of the vestibulospinal and the reticulospinal tracts, the patient would then become flaccid. And dead.
You got that? Can you tell me the difference then in these posturings? Should we look at it one more time?
Yeah.
Yes, no, one more time.
The patient is in the decorticate position with the upper extremities in flexion, the lower extremities in extension, reflecting that the brainstem motor centers are working, but we don't have modulation of those centers from the cortical spinal tracts and their connections to the brainstem centers. If we now go a step lower as far as the level of dysfunction and eliminate the function of the rubrospinals, we go from decorticate to decerebrate posturing. The lower extremities stay in extension, now the upper extremities are in extension because we don't have any type of regulation or modulation the vestibulospinal or the reticulospinal tracts, but we've eliminated the influence of the rugospinal tracts at this point in time. If there's to be further progression and the patient has further deterioration, we now eliminate the function of the vestibulospinal and the reticulospinal tracts, the patient would then become flaccid. And
dead.
Dead.
Gotta watch him do the phone. There we go. Okay, we got that. So now, so now I have no problem expecting you to know those postures, right? The corticate and the cerebral and flaccid. So if you saw a patient, you'd be able to say, ah, that's the corticate posture. And you'd be able to know what's worse. I can't think of when you would have seen a flaccid posturing except in the OR. I think that's the best description. Unless the person is dead or close to it. So, medications. We support the airway, obviously respirations, and we maintain nutritional status because anybody in these states cannot take in nutrients on their own, can they? So we're tube feeding them, TPA, sometimes there's surgery. Some nice nursing diagnoses for, again, if you haven't used them already. Risk for imbalanced nutrition is always a good one. They can take in less than the body requirements when there's any brain spring dysfunction. How about increased intracranial pressure? I know that some of you in general have been to the OR and seen some brain surgery, right? Have seen anybody? Yeah, okay. Tell somebody, what did you see?
It was
to take off intracranial pressure from a hematoma, or?
Well, I don't know, because he had hematomas on the side of his brain.
Well, then, yeah, no. The intracranial pressure.
Yeah,
so we needed to get rid of that. Right. So what was the surgery? Yeah. So tell us about it.
They did burr holes, so they cut the scalp.
What's a burr hole? Drilled into the scalp.
The skull. They cut the scalp and then put clamps to make like stop bleeding and cauterized it so it wouldn't bleed more. And then they scraped the grafts on the skull and then used a drill to drill into the skull, got to the dura and then sliced the dura and then basically, like, it had been since November, since he had fallen and gotten them.
Yeah.
So there was, like, clots at the top of the dura. So they had this little fluid.
So it's like a bruise on the brain. Yeah. He had a hematoma on it.
Yeah. And so they went in and, like, had this little, it was like a little hook. And
okay.
Grabbed the blood clot and pulled out the blood clot and the blood just drained.
And you just drained out of the burrow. Sometimes they take off a whole section of the skull. No.
It had the potential of opening up to a full craniotomy if it didn't drain.
If it didn't drain, but it did. So intracranial pressure can be a huge deal. Why? What's happening if there's pressure for some reason in the brain, like this patient? What's happening to all the nerves that you just learned about? They just got refreshed time. What's happening to all those nerves? Potential damaging, right? They're getting pressure on them. They might not be getting oxygenated, right? So they're going to lose function. If these nerves aren't maintained, what's going to happen to the body?
Function.
Yeah. Was your patient symptomatic, you know, before going to surgery? Do you know anything about the case?
Yeah, they didn't really tell me anything about it.
Yeah.
He literally had just come into the ED, and they did a scan and like saw that they were getting the body surgery.
So in this case, it was an edema, right? Basically, it was swelling caused by the hematoma. Can be a lesion, hydrocephalus, water on the brain. Usually that's cerebrospinal fluid. That's on the brain. Swelling, like in this case, excessive cerebrospinal fluid, and hemorrhage, bleeding, can all cause intracranial pressure. Hydrocephalus is the abnormal production, circulation, reabsorption of the cerebrospinal fluid, and that can also cause communicating or non-communicating. Communicating means is it limited to one side of the brain or is it bilateral? So in that case, that hemorrhage was communicating, non-communicating, was it bilateral or that, not hemorrhage, that hematoma? Do you remember? Was it, did you?
It was, well,
sides?
Yeah.
But it was a bilateral, and it was a communicating.
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes you're limited to just one side of the brain. Remembering your brain anatomy, that's very possible. A brain herniation is potentially lethal. Brains can herniate. So what you're going to get when you have these kind of abnormalities, you may see some personality changes. Level of consciousness is decreased, some paralysis, all this kind of stuff. So it makes it, the diagnosis could be rather tricky, huh? But luckily today we have MRIs. We have great machines that can take pictures that will show us pretty much what's going on. We treat the underlying cause, and this Emily was explaining a nice surgery. He was on mechanical ventilation, of course, that was pretty common. Here's a nice diagnosis for you in defective tissue perfusion, cerebral tissue perfusion. That's basically what's going on. Of course, you can always put risk for infection. What is a persistent vegetative state? Anybody have been with a patient in a persistent vegetative state? I know in Sunrose we're doing some neuro stuff. Any of those people in? You guys that got to hang with the neuro? No? It's a death of the cerebral hemisphere, okay? So think about that. That's the front part of the brain is dead. But the brainstem and the cerebellum are functional. Okay? So this person has sleep-wake cycles. You look at them, they blink their eyes, they look absolutely normal. But there's no higher level thinking. They can't interact with you at all. They can't eat, they can't. There's nothing but spastic movement. There's no purposeful movement, okay? And I think one of the most challenging things I ever did as a nurse was be with a woman who had to make a decision about her husband that was like 50 years old and in a persistent vegetative state. And I don't remember how he got there. It was a fall or something. It wasn't anything he did. Okay, so there he is lying in the bed. He's going to sleep. He's waking up. He's a handsome man. To look at him, you would think that any moment he would just turn and look at you and start talking. Because that's how he looked. He looked like any of us who were just sitting, or in this case, lying, relaxed. There, you know, not necessarily focusing on anything. You would expect him at any moment to just turn and say, "Hi, how's it going?" But because of the tests we have now, it was determined that he had no brain activity in the cerebral hemisphere. None. So what's the state of this guy? He's never going to get better. He's just going to lie there. But after this experience, I can really understand why it's so very difficult for families to say, "That's okay, let him die." Which this woman did, because she said their pledge to each other was never to let the other live in this kind of state, as none of us would want to do, of course. So how did he die?
Starvation.
He can eat, so he's being fed by a feeding tube. So how are we going to let him go? Unfortunately, the only way is just to withdraw fluids and sustenance, and that's what she did. Took 2.5 weeks.
Oh, how long does that normally take for them to pass?
It took him 2.5 weeks. And that's pretty long.
There's no other way to do it.
Think about it. Can you think of any other way to let him die? Can't kill him, it's illegal.
Yeah, I know.
Isn't that awful? Like the morning class said, well, wouldn't that be a good case for, you know, if we're an organ, can we do that patient suicide thing? Why couldn't we do the patient suicide thing? If we were an organ. I mean, not an organ, but say we were.
Don't you need the patient to say they want to die?
You need the patient to say they want to die, if not actually administer the refill.
Wait, so you
could
kill them if they say they want to die?
If you're an organ. In a few places, and in Holland, in a few places in the world, there is a law that enables someone to do that. Under extreme circumstances, it's not legal in California. So, yeah. Katie?
Almost all of our patients at Alameda are in persistent vegetative states, and a couple of them, the last time Maria and I were there, a couple of them passed away during the week before that we weren't there, and it went way faster than that, but that's because they were
really?
On the vents, so they were and with your nutrition and
food. Yeah, this guy was particularly interesting in that he was on the pen. He looked fine. That's what was really so awful about it. Someone on the vent is far easier because then you're saying you can't breathe on your own. This guy was breathing.
Some of them, though, like, they can breathe on their own, but they can't keep their O2 gas up high enough.
So then they're
not
for
very long. Exactly.
So. Assisted ventilation.
And it's really, I mean, it's crazy, I feel, because there's some that have been there for so many years. Like, there's one case that he almost drowned when he was 2, so he didn't receive enough oxygen from his brain, which is an anoxic.
Perfect, anoxic brain injury. Beautiful. See, I'm so proud of you. See, I'm
and
you see
his twin sister actually did die. She actually drowned, and they were able to save him. But he's been that way for 34 years now. And they have.
Is he ventilated?
Mm-hmm.
So he's just growing. He grew all the way from 2 into a man.
Yeah,
he's just a body that's been
not
naked.
The right, he didn't grow the right way.
Oh, he didn't?
No, he's really deformed.
Not deformed,
like,
but it's a result of his disease.
Well, he had like
hypothyroid
disease.
Yeah, and he has no muscle mass at all.
Yeah.
No muscle development. So it's just, you guys have been taking care of just bodies. How's that feel? I'd be a lot of freaked out.
But now I think it's more like because we were, it's not weird to get used to it, but I guess more used to it. It's just harder dealing with the families because some of the families come in and like I struggle all the time with like, why aren't you letting this person go? So.
Actually, in my practice, that was my problem. After doing it for a few years, I'm like, am I doing any good? It gets to the ethical point of, if you spend your whole day with 5 people that can't interact with you at all, that have no brain function, you're thinking, is this even right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of ethical considerations that go on that are involved in people in a persistent dead case. I think this lady who let her husband go was amazingly brave. Because very often, this is what you see. People live for years, and you can understand it. And looking at these people, because they look fine, right? They look, and this guy wasn't even on bed. They look absolutely fine. They're going to wake up and start talking any minute. I mean, they're awake. Their eyes are open. Wake sleep cycles, the whole thing. Very scary. So it's a fascinating part of nursing. The condition must persist for at least a month. Now, did any of you hear that about that baby? Yeah, tell us about the baby. You heard about
the baby. I always saw it on Yahoo.
Yeah, well, that's good enough.
I briefly looked at it.
What happened?
Because apparently an infant was declared dead and then put her...
A stillborn, meaning born dead.
Born dead. And then they had it in the little coffin and everything, and then...
In the morgue.
And then it started crying. So... Yeah. And then she, I guess, opened it and saved his life.
What?
The morning class brought up the point that the death certificate was made up, the time of death was 20 minutes after the birth. If you note, where is it on my next slide? No, on this slide. It's supposed to be, you're supposed to wait like a good half hour or whatever before you make that kind of diagnosis. Particularly with the newborns, since they're amazing. I mean, half the time they're born, they look like they're dead, and then they pop right back, you know? Because the birth process is awful. It's really hard to make. So, right? Patrick was really blue. So you can see how the mistake could easily be made, but you're supposed to wait a bit. So yeah, this baby was in a consistent vegetative state.
She was in the hospital.
She was in the morgue. Oh, I have no idea. I just heard this yesterday. Have you guys heard the follow-up? I've been preaching all day. Are they going to?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is surprising.
The baby's alive. Yeah. Did you hear the one about where they put the baby to freezer and then it came back to life and then it died because it had to be freezing?
That's not surprising. We put them in the fridge all the time and when I was working, they'll be just still running in the fridge. Okay, but persistent vegetative Alameda states are diagnosed after one, I think the month of his condition. So it usually takes that long to go through all the tests and make a real sound diagnosis that this person is not changing. There is no cerebral hemisphere function. At that point, the families are given instructions of what to do, and as this lady pointed out, sometimes the people just slip. Now, this is different than locked-in syndrome. Have you worked with locked-in syndrome people in Alameda? It's a little different than persistent
therapy. I think so.
You probably have.
I had a patient that had multiple sclerosis, and at least like a couple weeks before I had her anyway, she could still respond with blinks for like yes and no. But then when I worked with her, she couldn't anymore.
That's a good example of a locked-in syndrome. They're going to present exactly like your persistent vegetative state person, except they have full cognition. Okay, so as you walk into that room, unless you know you're not going to see any different manifestations. But someone with locked-in syndrome is completely cognitive aware. So in my practice, I wouldn't differentiate. I would just go in and talk. I go in and talk to everybody. I pretend that they understand me. And I'm sure you did with the persistent vegetative state people. Yeah, it's just kind of the way we are with nurses, what are we going to do? But quite honestly, in my practice, when I was working a lot with persistent vegetative state, I got so depressed about them that I stopped talking to them. Because it got really hard for me.
And you guys have a lot of the nurses there already. Yes,
they don't talk to them. It's all,
They don't.
You don't talk to them. No. I can completely understand that. It gets extremely depressing. But your locked-in syndrome patient, you absolutely want to talk to. Because they're there. They're the kind that wake up and say, I heard you talking. And they know what's going on. Right? So they have intact cognitive ability, but a complete inability to communicate. No movement, no speech, but full brain activity. And locked-in syndrome. And then there is brain death, which is complete sensation of all function, including the brain stem. And that's... Today we can keep people alive that are brain dead, can't we? Unfortunately, we can't. We can keep on ventilators, we can...
Don't we keep people alive sometimes so their organs are still good?
We absolutely do, yes. Yes, brain dead people, we keep them alive so that their organs can be harvested. And that may be a couple days until we get everything in line so that we can harvest the organs. So we do that. Keep them ventilated, keep their blood pumping, their hearts going. Which is miraculous. And a body like that can save many, many people. So brain death is a completely unresponsive coma. No response. No motor reflexes, nothing. No reflexes, nothing at all. No spontaneous movement. Pupils are fixed and dilated. With your people in different stages of cognition, did you see any fixed and dilated pupils?
That one that has been conceived.
That's a real good indicator of brain activity, people's pupils. Absence ocular response is a flat EEG, of course, no heart and no cerebral blood flow. We're talking brain death. For brain death, you have to have manifestations of 30 minutes to an hour, which I would have assumed they would have waited for this baby, and they didn't.
They also all, most of them respond to, suctioning, they...
Oh, so there is some reflexive movement.
And this one, the one that
we
talked about, he doesn't even move
fast, actually. He's not persistent. He's brain dead. He's not persistent vegetative. He's beyond that.
His chart says persistent
vegetative.
Does it? Yeah, they
don't. Well, I don't know if the insurance would pay for keeping a brain dead person alive. I mean, the diagnosis would have to be persistent vegetative state because there is absolutely no medical reason to keep a brain dead person alive. Mm-hmm. But if he's like, he sounds it. That's awful. Yes?
So if you have a patient who doesn't blink, how do you maintain the eyes? Is it just eye drops?
Ladies, how do you maintain the eyes? That is a problem. Absolutely. And the mouth and the lips. Yeah. Very much. And the contractures. Is it contracted? Completely contracted, right?
Yeah.
Can you explain what a contracture is?
Well, it's when our hands are like this.
And the elbows and the hands.
Yeah.
It's like this.
And if you try to, you take your blood pressure, you try to put it on the way, and you can't.
Because the musculature, the muscles just shorten out of disuse, and the hands are just. It's so bad the fingernails would grow into the palms. Mm-hmm.
So most of them have like rolls, so that their fingers don't grow into there.
Because if left unattended, the fingernails will actually grow into the palms. From this. But if they had waited the 30 minutes to an hour for that baby, maybe she would have been had a better fate, right? What are our main concerns about that child that's been rescued from the world now? What's your main worry today, right now, for that baby?
Malnutrition.
No?
Oxygen.
Oxygen, what?
Deficiency in other brain.
Exactly, exactly. Brain deprived from oxygen, for how long? There's a good chance it was, right? And what are we gonna see then? Anoxic brain injury, right? Yeah. A brain injury is her brain most likely is injured from an anoxic brain injury, as if she died. Would be my guess. We'll see. Maybe not. Miracles happen. It's amazing. Seizures. All right. I have another video for you. Let's hope it doesn't take quite so long. There's my seizure videos. I'll show you a seizure since I can't act it out very well. That is an outstanding opportunity for you to work with these sorts of patients. You never get it in this class.
And in a horrible way, it's like Katie and I were saying how like we can give them an injection and not be too worried about how they're going to yell back at us or react. Mm-hmm. You know?
But the bad thing is you can't
but
practice.
We're losing our communication skills.
Exactly. You can't practice any communication.
Which we're hopefully getting in Jerry.
So. I hope. Yeah. But we'll get it right. You're going to get to see a seizure real soon, I promise. Grandma. We're going to talk about three different kinds of seizures. A clonic tonic, which is what you'll see, I hope. A focal or absent seizure, what is that? And actually the physician on this video has a little different name for it. What's a focal or absent seizure? Do you know? Children just stare. You can't, there's no muscle movement. It's just a brain stare. They're just sunk down. And then a partial seizure is... It's just one part of the body. Okay. Three basic kind of seizures that maybe this guy's going to address if we ever knows. So with him a lot of talking. It's really good. I really want to see the seizure. Yes. Am I doing something
wrong? It's called an absent seizure.
Absent seizure, yeah, or focal. Yeah.
Yeah, one of my best friends has epilepsy, and I was actually with her when she had an absent seizure. And it's weird because they just zone out. Like, because she knows when she's going to go into a seizure sometimes, because she'll have these things, and she calls them spells.
She has a what would she call it?
She calls them spells, because like spells. She can tell like that her body is doing something different. And so she was like, oh, I'm going into a spell, and then she just zoned out for like 3 minutes. Yeah, it was like, not 3 minutes, maybe like, it felt like 3 minutes. It was probably
like about
a
now.
Minute or less.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was pretty scary.
I bet.
Yeah.
I see one of those too, and it was, we didn't know, she said she could feel it too, or she zones out, she has epilepsy as well. The night before a softball game, we were kind of in a weird, like, setting, and she's also just like this. We all backed up because we thought something bad was like happening or coming towards us, and all of a sudden she just like collapsed and Luckily, her dad was a coach, and he knew what to do, but...
And she's left her, right?
Yeah, she's athletic, yeah.
That's
I had my roommate at a time, she had one of those seizures, you know, the photosensitive ones when you play a lot of video games.
Really?
Yeah. And I think she was playing video games for like four 3 days in a row. I mean, she did have some stops, you know, to eat and things like that, but it was like 3 days in a row.
Wow.
And she had a full-on seizure. I was sleeping at the time.
A full-on.
Yeah, and she screamed. She screamed, and that woke me up. And I saw her. She was, you know, on both sides. She was moving. I left there because she was falling off the chair.
A lot of folks.
But I caught her.
They have no idea what to do. They have no idea why it's happening. And I've also seen bystanders say, well, that person's just, they're crazy. Why are they acting so strange? Why aren't they responding to me? Well, there's a very simple reason why people have seizures. Now, seizures themselves, it's not necessarily a disease. Usually it's a symptom of a disease. And, you know, the brain is a very complex organ. It sends messages to your body. For instance, if I want to move my left arm, the right side of my brain will create electrical activity, telling me to move the left side of my body, my left arm, my left leg. But in a seizure victim, what happens is your battery, your brain is like a battery. And it sends all these electrical charges and impulses. And it starts losing control, and your brain literally will go crazy, sending electrical impulses everywhere. And as it does that, it sends signals to your body to contract and extend. And that's when you see what's called the tonic-clonic grand mal seizures, where someone loses control of their ability to not only think and process information, but they have absolutely no control over their bodies or their bodily function. And what's so interesting, guys, about seizures is there are different types. There are partial seizures where someone will come into the ER and they'll say, you know what, I can't stop my left arm from moving. That means the area of your brain that controls your left arm is having seizure-like activity, all those electrical impulses. Tonic-clonic, used to be called grand mal seizures, that's a very common reason people come to the ER. But there's something else called absence seizures. Often seen in kids where they'll be in class and they'll just have staring spells. And all of a sudden the teacher will think, wow, they just never paid attention.
You just kind of have it for a few seconds or a minute or so.
But they're having a seizure. That electrical overstimulation is occurring in a certain part of the brain. These people who have these seizures usually don't know they're seizing. They're unconscious. And so it's up to you, the bystander, to do something.
And the first thing you do, you want to protect the person. Like you saw in that video, that person will be laid on their side. That way, if they do spit up or vomit, they won't choke on it. They'll just come right out of their mouth. The other thing is you want to protect them from anything around. If there's furniture, something they may bump into, move it out of the way. And the last thing, try to have something soft under their head, because if they're moving their head a lot, they could be banging their head against something. You want to protect their head from that.
And actually, you want to really observe a seizure, because you're going to be able to report this to a doctor. So you want to be able to tell, was it an absence seizure? Was it a tonic-clonic? What were they doing with their body? But also, you want to time the seizure, because if it lasts more than 5 minutes, then you may need to call 911, or if there's repeated or multiple seizures and the person doesn't have a chance to recover in between, then you also want to call 911, or if they have difficulty breathing as well.
Yeah, there's a couple things you should never do with somebody who's having a seizure, particularly a violent seizure, the so-called grand mal that you were describing. Number one, when this person is moving, don't try to hold them down, because you actually can cause bone fractures, other injuries to the musculoskeletal system. Don't try to put something in their mouth. You'll injure their teeth. They actually can dislocate their jaw joint, their TMJ joint. Don't give them liquids. Don't put anything else in their mouth, because they can aspirate, and then potentially the aspiration of bone damage could be lethal.
So a little bit more about seizure precautions. Actually, in the hospital, you're going to do exactly the same thing. What's most important for the nurse to do is observe what's happening during the seizure and to record it. And keep the patient safe, period. That's it. Take note about some things that went on before the seizure, like your friend. Was it somebody's friend? Yeah. Right. Whose friend had the the seizure. What went on? What brought that on before? I mean, what was sometimes are triggers, you know, that are important.
I don't think there was any trigger. She just felt it coming, and then
she did feel it.
And her dad came over, and he was really scared because she had gum in her mouth.
Yeah, good point.
And he didn't want her to choke on it, so he put on her side and then put his arm under her head so her head wouldn't hit. And then he tried to fling the gun out, and he finally got it. And then he just let it happen, and then she went to the doctors, and obviously she didn't play.
He obviously had done this before.
Yeah, she's had multiple. The whole team had to have a lesson on it just in case, because she's had it on the team before.
Sounds like he knew exactly
yeah.
what to do. Well, this guy doesn't hurry up, we're going to let him go because it's not all that. I've had a couple experiences where patients have faked seizures. Why would they fake a seizure? One was a Marin San Quentin prisoner. He liked it in the hospital much better than going back to San Quentin. So he faked a seizure. So what would be a good thing to test about whether he was faking it or not? The first thing the physician asked me. What do you think? From your vast knowledge of seizures here. What would tell her in this case whether or not he was faking? Quick, easy way to tell. They actually mentioned it in the video. Quick and easy way to tell if he was fake. Was he incontinent? Because remember, if you have a little seizure, you lose all control. Right? So she said, is he incontinent? Nope, sure. Go back to the general.
What do you mean by incontinent? So while there's
Yeah, they'll lose complete control of their bladder.
So they'll just go.
Let's go. And fecal material. Let's go.
Does that happen all the time?
Yeah, he loses control.
So what if they didn't have any in
there? Then you won't.
So then how would you know?
You would. But chances are there's going to be something in the bladder. It's unusual. Sure, for the bowel, yeah, there may not be anything. But for bladder, there's going to be. It would be extremely unusual if there would be any kind of moisture. She goes, we'll see if he says it. He was absolutely dry. Well, we're going to give up on what to expect from a seizure. But it's pretty much all those things that we talked about, okay? Back to seizures. Do you want lights or not?
No.
I put no cranial pressure, now we're on the seizures. So you got it down, right? Okay? Partial seizures. You may have an aura. They may know it's coming. They may not, like your friend with a partial seizure, he said. Okay? Planktonic absent seizures are generalized. Planktonic seizures. That's what's the picture that they showed. That was your friend with the conic. Sudden loss of consciousness, sharp tonic muscle contraction, loss of posture control. Okay, incontinence. Cyanosis, fixed dilated pupils. But you're going to have contractions. You have this relaxing contraction. That's why it's a chronic syndrome. It used to be called a grand mal. They regain consciousness. They're usually absolutely wiped out. They're so tired and usually. Nice diagnoses for us, particularly readiness for enhanced knowledge. You can use this one for a lot of things. Right. You learned a lot about stroke in Joe, right? I'm going to assume that Dr. Sheets covered stroke, ischemic and hemorrhagic, right? Two completely different causes. You've worked with a lot of stroke victims, correct? You know what's going on. Simply that one part of the brain has been ischemic, deprived oxygen is not functioning. You're showing it in the nerves, the lack of innervation, and you see things like facial drooping, hearing loss. Okay. Traumatic brain injury. Some of your patients at Alameda certainly are victims of traumatic brain injuries, right? Yeah, some of the history. Blood collects from the dura in the skull, it expands the dura that pulls away from the skull, loss of consciousness, headache, vomiting, normal kind of stuff. Get a lot of this in San Quentin inmates. Okay, they get hit over the head in the yard, traumatic brain injuries, often causing a subdermal hematoma, which is what Emily was able to see treated, correct? We learned all about that. Often drowsiness, confusion, enlarged pupils, unilateral headaches, hemi paralysis, and respiratory changes, which all makes sense. All right. Can be mistaken for dementia. So the elderly person falls, hits their head, has a traumatic brain injury, maybe a hematoma. They come into the hospital, we think they're just demented. That's why it's so important to have the family say, no, 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 something's going on. And so when they say that, listen to them. Because chances are there is something going on. It could be as simple as a UTI, let's hope, or as severe as a cerebral hematoma. And we can easily check those out with MRIs. We can find out what's going on. Concussions. Any experience with concussions? Anybody have it? Emily, you know. Tell us about that. Why did I know that?
I got hit in the head by a wall. Mm-hmm. It got caught in the sun and I turned my head and then it hit me in the face.
And did you black out?
Yeah.
How was that?
Weird. It was only for like, I didn't even black out for like a minute. Like I was like, I just like fell and then I just remember like my catcher standing over me. What happened? I know you got hit.
Oh. And then you came back pretty
okay.
Good. Loss of consciousness, transient pallor, bradycardia, hypertension, retrograde, and antegrade amnesia. So you had some memory?
Yeah.
Next, stressing diagnosis. Decreased intracranial adaptive capacity. Whoa, that's a good one. That's a nice one. Brain tumors. We talked about tumors. We talked about cancer. Tumors of the brain can be benign and malignant. They can be primary or secondary. Remember that, what that means. And my friend with breast cancer who died of brain, a breast cancer of the brain, which was a secondary, correct? But they could also have primary brain tumors. And they can be intracerebral or extracerebral. Compression of the brain tissue, changing level of consciousness, obviously a headache. Seizures, vomiting, and we treat them like we do any other cancer. All right, so we move on. Agenda today. That's advising. Okay, cranial displays. Moving to spinal cord disorders. Now, let me have spinal cord disorders or injuries.
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet that's pretty common. What were the histories of these people?
Well, one of them, he was driving drunk and hit a tree and severed his upper high C spine, completely severed.
So he is a quad. He is a quad.
And then there's another one that had a football accident and fractured.
So the classic, both those cases. The third one is the drunk college guy that falls off the balcony. Real common. More young men, right? In my experience, far more young men than women. And it's an injury that lasts for a lifetime. If you injure your spinal cord, or sever it in this case, how was it nursing him? How was that with that severely?
Family's always there, and they always speak Spanish, so it was really cool for me to be able to talk to his family and stuff.
I bet, and for them.
Yeah, because there's nobody on the floor that speaks Spanish when Katie and I are there. So it's really cool because when she tells us, like, oh, take care of my son, and then she like will try to tell us about his past and what he used to do before and things like that.
Heartbreaking, right?
Yeah.
And how is he?
He's in persistent vegetative state also.
Oh, so he does interact with you.
No, okay. But his mom is like holding on to hope that that's
and his lab values are all like dropping. He's been like that for almost 2 years.
I remember working with a mom that said, oh, well, it was, our son was in this, that similar state. He said, oh, well, you return to college in the fall. This is the guy that fell off the balcony.
Yeah. He's in his mid-20s, and he's got a son and a girlfriend, and
it just sucks. So sad. Anybody work with any paraplegics or quadriplegic patients? Yeah, tell us about it. How was it working with him? Anything you noticed specifically?
Her lip, she didn't have her lip, it was her legs.
So, paraplegia.
Yeah, she had, like me, she had to have a straight catheter, and she'd been that way for a long time, so she knew how to, she would do it herself at home.
Yes.
We would do it in, at the hospital. For when we were cleaning her for like bowel movements, every time you would roll her over, she had no control, so it was like every time you rolled her over, more would come. And it was, she had, the reason she was in there is because she had a lot of, she had a huge bed sore, like this big, and she had to have the skin flap put on it. And it's because she didn't move at home at all. She would just lay in bed. It's all I can remember. It was like one of my first couple patients, but.
Anybody?
And she was only like 31, I think, or something.
How about these people? How is it dealing with them? Have you ever noticed anything consistent? It can be really challenging. Yeah.
I've fed one during Jerry, not at the location I'm at now, but during the first 2 days when we went. Yeah, so I had experience feeding. It was interesting. It's so difficult. Just everything,
it is difficult.
Everything you do, it's really hard to challenge. So.
My experience has been they're extremely fussy. Very particular, very demanding. It can be tough on a nurse.
This one wasn't.
It wasn't.
Yeah, really
pleasant. Often because they have no control over it, or they have little control.
Mm-hmm.
It can be very challenging to us. Well, such a good example of spinal cord injuries. Obviously, ischemia and processing, you have injury. Automobile, you have this acceleration, deceleration kind of thing, a hyperflexion of the neck that can cause a break. Of course, a penetrating wound to the spine obviously is going to also cause. Problems with movement, sensation, perception, sexual function elimination, which you've all mentioned. All those things you've seen in your patients. Autonomic reflexia. Did anybody, in dealing with this population of patients, anybody come across this word or this concern? It's a high spike in blood pressure that can come from pressure in the body, often caused by a full bladder or bowels, which is why we're so concerned about emptying the bowels, emptying the bladder, like your lady, since you straight cow.
Every 4 hours.
4 hours. What other, sometimes regular Foleys, right? Indwelling Foley catheters, suprapubic Foleys, anybody seen suprapubic? Yeah, common in this population, right? The same?
Well,
I forgot. Was it a paraplegic? Oh, was it Jerry?
Yeah, a Jerry patient. And they just didn't want to do him. Or because they put like 8 or 9 catheters in him before, so they didn't want to have to keep doing that and allow him to get more infections. They just put this.
And can you describe to your classmates what a suprapubic catheter is?
It's like just straight into the
straight to the bladder from the outside skin, rather than going through the urethra. Okay, and it's used, yeah, when you're a straight cathing lady, started getting a lot of infections, it's just another way to do it. How do we deal with bowels? Your woman had uncontrolled bowel movements. That's not uncommon, but another. How about the paraplegic, or the quad, right? That you dealt with.
What
do you do about bowels?
What
did we do about bowels?
He had on a
brief. Yeah. Did he have uncontrolled bowel movements, or do you know what they did?
No, they just had him with that. At first, they had him with the Foley catheter for
uh-huh.
urine, and they took that off too because he was having way too many UTIs.
Yeah, so
they
just
changed
him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
ma'am. I had somebody with a spinal cord injury, a C1C2, and he had an urine catheter and
rectal tube, yeah, that's another way to do it. One thing that's common in long-term quadriplegics or paraplegics that have no bowel function is we get the body into very much routines, and we do what's called ditch stim, so we digitally stimulate just a few inches inside of the anus and the rectum, and the stimulation can cause peristalsis. So often that's a lovely nursing job that we get to do, is help them have a bowel movement every day. And bodies, people have been at this for a long time, their bodies get conditioned and they easily respond to that kind of thing. And peristalsis happens and they have a bowel movement. So that's it. I think it's extremely important that we do monitor their bowels to avoid this autonomic reflex. Skin integrity, we talk about that. Thrombosis, obviously. Altered elimination, yeah. And sexual function, absolutely. If they have no movement, is a concern. Spinal cord injuries, you'll notice, you know, in all the movies, what do? The first thing, they put a collar on someone, right, after an accident. Yeah, no matter what, even if we suspect that there's any chance of a spinal cord injury, we want to immobilize the spine. We certainly don't want to move and compress anymore until we can get medical treatment. So immobilization is really important. Sometimes surgeries can help. Sometimes we can take the pressure off an area. And sometimes rehabilitation can help, sometimes. Not always. How about meningitis? Any experience with meningitis? Anybody's ever had it? It's often community-based, so it's not uncommon to crop up in college populations. No? Any of your friends? It's an infection into the brain. It can be chronic or acute, bacterial or viral. There's a pretty easy test for it. What can you think about what that might be? An easy?
Is it the light? The
photosensitive?
The light?
They can be photosensitive, but what's a test that we could do? Not actually, not nurses, physicians, but what do we commonly see? Sometimes done at bedside. We do a spinal tap, okay, lumbar puncture. And we actually take out some cerebral spinal fluid. Cerebral spinal fluid is clear, it looks like water when it's healthy. If it was infected, if we suspected meningitis, what would we see if a positive for meningitis in a differential diagnosis would be what? What would the spinal fluid look like? Any ideas? Think about a Foley. Cloudy, exactly like urine. Not, I mean, it doesn't look like urine, but the same idea. If you're suspecting UTI, you see cloudy urine. If you're expecting meningitis, you can see cloudy cerebral spinal fluid. So if it comes out cloudy, we're concerned. The infection can be viral, fungal, parasitic, bacterial, okay? Fever, chills, headache, abdominal, stiff neck is real common. Right. What else? Encephalitis, general infection of the brain, again, bacterial, fungal. Right. Necrotizing hemorrhage, why are we worried about that? Necrotizing, that's when tissue dies, right? You don't want that. Edema, degeneration of neurons. Encephalitis can be very dangerous. And similar to meningitis, lethargy, drowsiness, declining level of consciousness, common, obviously. Sore throat, fever, stiff neck tremors, pretty similar to meningitis. Can go into seizures and paralysis depending on what areas of the brain are affected. You can have a brain abscess from encephalitis, same kind of thing. Depending on the localization of the abscess, and have those areas involved. Tetanus. Anybody have any experience with tetanus? Got your tetanus shots, right? We all did, obviously in clinical, but also every 10 years for your patients. Okay, they should be redone every 10 years. Tetanus can contaminate open wounds, and people still, believe it or not, develop tetanus and die from it. There's a period of incubation, and these are the spores, the C. tetani spores. Jaw and neck, dysphagia, perspiration, drooling. Okay, it's not, it's often a lethal disease, not fun at all. All sorts of complications. Rabies. Do we know anything about rabies? Our animals are all vaccinated, right? Humans occasionally get rabies too, potentially fatal, infection of the CNS, viral, yeah?
One of my friend's brothers, my brother's friends at UOP thought it'd be funny to bring in a cat they found, and he actually got bit and got rabies from the cat, and the cat had like a seizure and it died in the room, and they got in so much trouble.
Well, yeah.
It was insane, but yeah, it's
the cat has all the since he's a lie coach, eventually seizure and death, yeah. So he had to go through all those horrible injections.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a series of injections for humans that generally stop rabies. Most people don't die of it because we have this antidote, but yes. Irritability, depression, symptoms of infection, light, sound, temperature, poor cat, convulsions, right? Let's call it a convulsion rather than a seizure.
Yeah,
it's seizure. Apnea and death for the poor cat, right? And actually, it was good that that cat showed those extreme symptoms because I'm sure it caused the young man to go have treatment. Or otherwise, he would have thought, oh, the cat is just depressed. He wouldn't have done anything about it. So actually, I guess it was a blessing that cat convulsed and died in the room. Botulism, food poisoning, don't forget that, all right? Skeletal, muscle, and respiratory paralysis caused by botulism, visual disturbances, all of this stuff, okay? Ventilatory dysfunction. All right, moving on to neurodisorders. First neurodisorder I want to talk about is multiple sclerosis. And shall I try once more and see if I can load a video? I have all these wonderful things I have for you. And I'm just so bummed that they're not able to show them so easily as I like. So let's try it again. Maybe some people are off the computer and it's letting down. Maybe. So what do you know about multiple sclerosis? Anything? Hopefully this lady who has it will tell us a little bit about it. I'm hoping. Maybe? Lovely, if I don't get to show you, you can certainly watch on your own. A young woman describing her experience with multiple sclerosis. How she loses control of her body, she equates it to being drunk. Where you're trying to maintain control and you can't, which is really challenging. As she slowly loses control of her body. Young people, between 20 and 40, I believe. So disappointing. It's really fun to watch it and then talk about it, you know? Shall we get rid of this and try it one more time? It will load faster. Now we will load. So take some time to watch it, though, because it's absolutely really interesting to learn about multiple sclerosis from the person that has it, and to listen to her, to listen to what she goes through. The disease is progressive. She's in her 20s, it appears, and she talks about how she's slowly losing control of her body, slowly losing control of function. Yeah. And now she quits it just being drunk. You don't have full awareness of your body and how worse it gets. It's a leading cause of it's a neurologic disability. It's more frequent in colder northern latitudes and twice as likely for females, ages 20 to 40. The onset is pretty young. Sensory loss, visual disturbance, weakness, paralysis, and please take a look at when the things aren't as crowded. Take a look at this video as she explains all this. How she feels dizzy, how she's weak, so weak that she can't pick up anything. Yeah?
My neighbor has MS, and she told me that sometimes she all of a sudden, her body would go so weak that she'd fall on the floor, and she'd be conscious of everything, but that she couldn't, move anything.
Yeah, it's not a brain deal. It's unlike what we've been talking about, this is a neurological condition. It's not great, it's fine. Yeah, exactly. It can be more progressive. I remember watching a friend of my son's in her wheelchair taking her child to school, and over the years watching her progressively deteriorate, you know. She started walking when they were in kindergarten, and in sixth grade they were in a wheelchair, and watching her. It's sad, you see them in, it's common, more common in women, you see them in middle age, and then they're hospitalized, respiratory problems, cardiac problems, and eventually death. It's pretty bad. The diagnosis is made by two or more exacerbations separated by 1 month or more. People have a history of exacerbations of remission, so they may feel fine for a period of time and then be bad for a few months and then feel fine and bad. Increasing manifestations for at least 6 months is the diagnosis. We do MRIs, cerebral spinal fluid, CTs. The diagnosis, not a lot of treatment. We can do surgeries for deformities, again, if someone's contracted, we can do surgery for that. There's really no treatment at this point for it. I've got another great thing on Huntington's, which I would love to show you. Shall I try Huntington's?
Sure.
I'll make my Huntington's video. This is great. You really get a sense of feel from this. About Huntington's and what it's like to live with it when you see this guy, if you get to see this guy. Hopefully you see this guy. His name is Daniel, and he's completely spastic, you know, and that's what Huntington's is. It's a genetic disorder. He, in this video, talks about how he's very concerned about his daughter getting it. Talks to his brother having to shave him. It's a spastic kind of dance-like movement. Again, completely lose control of your body, and this is hereditary. And you're not getting it at all, but you can go home and watch it and enjoy it. In this case, the morning class was much better. So Huntington's is progressive, again. Degenerative is familial, it's genetic, there's no cure. It's progressive neurologic degradation. I mean, the nerves just stop functioning. Increasing dementia, so in this case, the brain is involved. Okay. And chorea, which is kind of dance-like muscle contractions. And when you watch the video of this guy, you'll see him kind of spastic, kind of uncontrollable movements. And we don't know. We can't make an absolute 100% diagnosis until postmortem examination. We can look at the brain, look at the cell. Progressive dementia, which is really sad. Because not only do they lose complete control of their bodies, they lose their mental function as well. Severe depression, memory loss, emotional ability, and impulsiveness. Facial grimacing gesturing. He looks like a classic dyspastic kind of individual. But I'm anxious for you to see the video of him, so be sure to take a look, because it'll bring all this real forward, and you can see this guy. Obvious risk for aspiration, imbalanced nutrition. How are they going to eat? And that's a real problem. This man looks like someone takes very good care of him, his brother, it appears, and feeds him, but how's he going to eat? Impaired skin integrity, verbal communication, ALS. Should I give up on my videos altogether? ALS is what my patient had that I told you about. Also called Lou Gehrig's disease. Someone this morning asked, why is it Lou Gehrig's disease? Why is it Lou Gehrig's? Anybody know? Lou Gehrig had it. Who is Lou Gehrig? Some famous baseball player, yeah, who died of ALS and basically brought the disease into the forefront of the population, so whatever around it. It's rapidly progressive, it's degenerative. The thing with this and why it's different than Huntington's for a couple of reasons. We don't really know what causes it. There's not a known genetic link. And the other thing is, in this disease, you retain full mental cognition. There's no dementia. So although you lose complete control of your body, it starts in the legs, goes up, 2 to 5 years after onset, generally there's death. A complete mental consciousness, so you're very aware of everything that's going on. Normally, often people die at the point where they can't breathe on their own. but you have the option at that point of having a respirator. The man in the video that I have chosen for you is not to that point yet. That'll probably be his choice in the next year or two, whether he decides to go on a ventilator. Then they can live for a few more years. So this 5 years is without ventilator assistance. There are some ALS patients that can live for quite a while with a ventilator. And you, any ALS patients in Alameda? No ALS? Generally, they're not hospitalized because they just send them home. Because there's not anything we can do for them. Actually, it sounds like some of your patients there's nothing we can do for them either. And the complete cognition, progressive degeneration, it is fatal, muscle weakening and wasting. So what's muscle wasting? What happens when the muscle wastes? Because of lack of use, it completely deteriorates. Okay, so like my patient, who I looked at pictures of him, was a big broad-shouldered man, my height, but you know, big kind of guy. He was way smaller than me. He weighed 120 pounds when he died.
120?
Yeah. For him, that was like tiny. Real, real small. Muscle wasting, progressively degenerative. So my patient, at the end, I was noticing a difference. When I first met him in November, he could smile, extremely expressive. I could understand him only because I was with him so much. Speech gets real difficult. Eventually, he stopped even trying. Because he couldn't talk. The muscles in his face would no longer work. So we communicated a lot with his facial expressions at the end that he couldn't even, he was lost, losing movement in his face. Completely nothing. Often you don't get to see a full end-stage ALS patient because they opt to not have the ventilator. They opt to not put on it. So you don't get to see the final stages. I was privileged enough to be able to see it all the way to the end and see these last, what finally goes, which is the facial, which is fascinating. And it's fatal. Okay. Neurons in the spinal cord. Muscles twitching, slurred speech, moves on. When you see the little video of this man with it, you'll be able to see all this. It brings it forward pretty well. Myasthenia gravis. Any experience with that? Anybody know? No? More in men, greater manifestations in people older 50. Chronic. Now, this is an autoimmune disorder. In the videos I chose for you, it's a lady that has it. And you'll be able to see her and her symptomology. It's a neuromuscular disorder, and again, periods of remission and exacerbation. Thank you. Myasthenia gravis. Autoimmune, meaning the body basically is attacking the neurons itself, or its own neurons. Antibodies destroy or block neurotransmissions at the junction receptor sites, okay? So then the spark can't make that jump. It's retarded. And it's a decreased ability of the muscles to contract. So they become flaccid after a time. And the disease progresses. There's complications, obviously. For all these diseases, infective airways, volume fatigue, work for any of them. Guillain-Barré. Anybody have a patient with Guillain-Barré yet? This is a fascinating disease. It's a peripheral neurological disorder. Okay. What's cool about this is it comes and goes. If you can hold out through the course of this disease, which generally is not longer than 2 years, your chances of survival are excellent. But the problem is living through it. Okay. Can you live through this degenerative disease? It's viral or bacterial. It can be secondary to a viral or bacterial infection. That's the thought. And there's not a lot of treatments. All we do with these people is we see them in the hospital quite a bit, keep them alive until the disease runs its course. So what's the problem? Let's say you've lost all bowel control, you've lost bladder control, you're in the hospital, and we're just kind of waiting for this disease to be done. But what are you now at risk for? Any nosocomial infection is hanging around the hospital, right? So often, in the meantime, depending on their strength, on their immune system, they die waiting for the disease to get over. Other times, people can completely, more often, they completely survive. Guillain-Barré comes and goes, which is a nice thing about it. 20% of the patients do require ventilation. It gets to the point where they can't breathe on their own. That is pretty darn scary. So it can be extremely detrimental. Motor paralysis, usually ascending in nature, again, from the legs up to the point where they have no movement. Even they can't breathe on them. But given enough time, most of the time they recover, which is pretty cool. The myelin sheath are destroyed, but they grow back, which is really neat. Weak muscles, lower extremities, cognition and level of consciousness, again, in this disease is not affected. So they're purely, they're right there with you all the time. Which again is sometimes a blessing and sometimes a curse, right? Because they know everything that's going on and can make their own decisions. Guillain-Barré is, and ALS, sometimes the diagnoses are confused. Of course, you're going to hope for Guillain-Barré, right? Yeah. But the manifestations are somewhat similar. But in Guillain-Guillain, it's not going to be, it's Guillain-Barré, the people get better in ALS, which is the main difference. Otherwise, they're going to present in a very similar manner. We're going to keep them, what's our biggest thing with all these patients is oxygenation, right? We're going to keep them ventilated. What else about them? Nutritional support, yeah, they can't eat on their own. Usually peg tubes, that kind of thing. Powerlessness, again, very niceness and diagnosis. Impaired swallowing, impaired air controls, all that. Bell's palsy, anybody know anything about that? Another nice video on Bell's palsy. A woman talks all about her experience with Bell's palsy. 20 to 60 years old, men and women are affected equally. Again, secondary to a viral or bacterial infection. Okay? Half the face goes numb. Usually the duration is about 6 weeks. You start seeing improvement within 6 weeks. Treatment is corticosteroids, all right, and acyclovir. Now, why that combination of meds? Acyclovir is what? Anybody know? Antiviral. Okay, so we're going to hit the viral, usually viral, and then steroids to keep down the inflammation. So the nerves of the face, one side unilateral, are causing complete paralysis. In our little 12 cranial nerve song, they mentioned Bell's palsy and the specific nerves that are affected and the result in Bell's palsy. It's fascinating, but it's very, very subtle. It's very scary when you see it. It's like a young person who looks like they've had a stroke. That's exactly the same presentation. Half the face is completely flaccid. They have trouble eating, trouble swallowing. Of course, you have to hear their aspiration, all that kind of thing. Okay. I'm so sorry that you've got to go home and watch my videos, I promise you, okay? These are really good. I spent a lot of time choosing them so that you can see people with these disorders. What about strokes and headaches? I'm going to assume you know a lot about strokes. So let's move on and talk about some headaches. We're going to talk about tension headaches, cluster headaches, cranial arteries as a cause of headaches, migraines as secondary headaches. Tension headaches you're all familiar with, right? Is there anyone who's never had a tension headache? I'm sick of being as cautious when I leave. I can't show this out early. We don't get to watch any of those cool videos. Right? Been in school way too long. You're getting tense. Right? And you know what that feels like. A band, tightness, steady, constant. If you're able to relax, it goes away with a nap or in a couple hours, right? Generally not a big problem. More chronic than severe. It's not a huge, intense headache, but probably the most common headache. Stress and headaches. Now, cluster headaches. There are some great videos about, I didn't download any or didn't select any for you, but there are some great videos online about cluster headaches. Seen more commonly in men, clusters 1 to 8 daily. They are severe, very, very painful. There are these videos, these men just go, the headaches come one after another. The pain is excruciating and often localized to one eye or here and then radiating out to the face. Incredible headaches. And this is a vascular headache. So what's going on with the vessels in the head to cause that kind of headache? What do you think? They're constricting, you think? How about dilating, putting pressure on everything? Doesn't that make more sense? Yeah, shucks. Good thought though, they're moving, yes. They're getting bigger. Putting pressure on and causing pain. It's a severe vascular headache. Yes.
So when you get those headaches or when you move your head around and it hurts, is that a tension headache?
No. More likely a migraine. More likely a migraine. Tell me more about it.
It's just like you kind of go to sleep at the same time when you get it, and then when you just shake your head in a certain way or just move your head around too much, it just hurts.
It's going to be, that's much more likely a vascular headache. Let's talk about migraines and see if that's what you have. I'm sure there are some migraine sufferers in the room, right? Some diagnosed migraine sufferers. We have a potentially undiagnosed. We can work you up. That's your topic. Come on, somebody has migraines. I know they have to. Yeah, okay, tell us about it. Camille, tell us about it.
My migraines, it's kind of like, sometimes they can be sudden onset, sometimes not. But most of the time, they just hurt so bad that I can't be in light, and if it's too loud, then it increases the headache. I just usually try to sleep it off, because that's all I can really do. I can't really move.
But you don't have any medication?
No. I try to, at least. Sometimes it's sometimes it pulses too, like when I move. So I try to just like lay there, and just in the dark. Try to sleep it off.
So you have a prodromal phase. So you say sometimes you know what's coming on.
Mm-hmm, sometimes.
And what does that feel like?
I get really tired and I feel lightheaded and I can't think straight.
Yeah, and some people have visual disturbances, like the flash of the light and that kind of thing. Yeah,
that's what I get. Yeah.
Good. Tell us about the prodromal phase.
When I get them, I always get blurry vision.
Yeah.
And it's like watching. And just to the point where, like, I can't go anywhere. Like, I can't drive. They're usually sudden. And if I get one, I can't go to school. I can't do anything. Like,
but you have this phase. You have that pre-phase. You know it's coming.
Yeah. The minute I know it's coming, I take medication, like Excedrin.
And does that work?
It does work.
All you need is Excedrin. Awesome. That's really lucky. That's really nice.
Yeah. My sister's the one, remember, who gets them, like, really, really bad. I told you about it before.
I probably forgot.
Where
she had medication to help her.
Sometimes the Excedrin works, but oftentimes it doesn't.
You know, there are prescriptive meds.
Yeah. It's not so bad anymore. She doesn't get them as much.
So, ladies, why do you think you get them? Camille, what's the causative factor? Causative factor of the migraines.
I think, at least for my sister, a lot of it has to do with her hormones. And that's why I got them more when I was younger, when I was 13 or 14.
That's a classic age monster. Yeah, it's teenage.
Yeah.
More common in women. Men absolutely get them. There's a familial tendency. Is this anything that keeps having migraines?
Sort of. I was wondering,
because
normally, for the most part, like, when I get headaches, it tends to be when it's hot outside and there's like a lot of temperature difference, and that makes sense with the vascular. But is that going to be considered a migraine?
Well, this is really questionable. What causes a migraine? Is it sinuses? Is it allergic? I have migraines. I feel they're caused by the mast cells in my body and the reaction to the allergens and causing the vasodilation. That's what I think. I think mine is allergically based. I mean, a reaction from like now when the sun's coming and we have lots of cloud cover. Yeah.
What kind of headache do you get if you have like a jolt of like caffeine or?
Actually, it could be a migraine because what is caffeine? What's it cause? Vasoconstriction, and it's a diuretic, right? Mm-hmm. So we're taking off fluid. So if you're used to, your body's used to so much caffeine and you don't have it, you're going to get vasodilation. You have a vascular headache.
And
whether it's a migraine or not, it's going to feel like it's the same thing. So we get to this kind of dicey thing. What do you call it? What is it? Well, I don't know. Do you have a migraine? I don't know. Do you? Are my sinus headaches or are they migraine? Migraine medicine works, so maybe they're migraine. I mean, I think migraine is almost a group of symptomology rather than a cause, in my opinion. So yeah, sure, that's a migraine. Because it fits all this, right?
Yeah, I get the pulsing and I have to lay down in the dark. I take the Excedrin, which has caffeine in it.
And caffeine is really a good treatment. Has that worked for you?
Yeah,
your sister?
Like your pizza and like your coat.
Yeah, I'll go to espresso. It's like much more fun.
Yeah.
Much more fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you want the vasoconstrictions of gastric headache. And then you were saying the blurred vision. What's that caused by?
Constriction.
No, the dilation and the pressure on the nerve. Okay, so no constriction. You're gonna, and then later in the migraine, you're going to get some constriction, but you get that initial vaso, and then it goes back down. That's why you get the visual disturbance in the beginning. That's the phase of dilation, then you get some constriction, so it's a back and forth. But yeah, caffeine can do it. How severe are these headaches?
Really bad.
Like how bad?
They can be like 8 or 9.
Come on, they can be worse than that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've lied in bed, if I could go to the ER, I would, but I can't get up.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's
yeah.
like worse than having my period.
Way worse.
Oh,
it's just having the cramps. It's
a worse pain.
Yeah.
It's really, really bad. Nausea, vomiting is not okay.
Yeah, I vomit.
And you see patients admitted to the hospital simply for pain treatment for migraines. And if you're a nurse, they're easy patients to get because all they do is sit in the dark and give them pain meds.
I had a migraine patient, actually. So
oh, they're a horrible patient for
yeah.
a student.
Well, I knew what he was like going through and I felt so bad for him.
Yeah, because it just lies there and...
Oh,
yeah, very debilitating. Unilateral, generally, one side of the face. Change of elevation, like you were saying. Put your head down, it hurts more.
Mm-hmm.
That's good, yeah.
How long do they usually last?
How long do they last?
Mine lasts a long time. Sometimes I sleep a whole day, and then even when I wake up, I still have a headache.
Yeah.
I think it's like usually like 24 to 48 hours.
Days. Somebody's point was saying usually 3 days.
Yeah, I don't get it at all.
Without treatment. And they come, they at least for me, they come in clusters, you know, I mean, a whole bunch. And in times of stress. Okay, so you got the idea? Severe headaches, we've talked a lot about it. Secondary headaches. We've talked about primary headaches, right? But also in our discussion today, we talked about lots of things that cause headaches and manifest themselves in headaches, like a brain aneurysm, a brain tumor, right? A subarachnoid hemorrhage, stroke. Some of these people that you've dealt with, the reason they came to the hospital may have been a headache, right? So remember that headaches can be secondary to many different things that need to be taken extremely seriously. So if an older person comes in and says they have a headache, and they're kind of unsteady on your feet, and they're acting a little demented, that could very well be some kind of a brain hematoma, right? Rather than just a demented old person with a headache. So think about the secondary headaches as a symptom to something more serious, which is not at all uncommon. Not that headaches themselves cannot be extremely serious. We do hospitalize people for cluster headaches and migraines. Migraines are extremely common, and yes, everything you said was correct. You have a good overview from your descriptions. You know about strokes. All I want you to know for these classes are hemorrhagic, they're ischemic, and depending on what brain cells are affected, that's where you see the degree of debilitation in the body, the manifestation. Okay. Any questions? I want to go home and watch my videos. I'm so sorry, but do watch them because they give you a great example of patients that are manifesting these disorders that we talked about. Please make sure I have all the exams and any of your exam review sheets that I haven't graded, and pick up anything you like from the table.
I'll just remind you if I can just go to the morning.
set up the
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That's